Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
You might know Herb Alpert from some of his songs, right? Spanish Flea, This Guy's in Love with You, A Taste of Honey. Big hits, like especially in the 60s. Did you know, though, that Herb Alpert is incredibly influential to modern music? He started one of the most important record labels ever. He wrote some of the biggest songs for the likes of Sam Cooke. He's 88 years old, and he's still touring. He'll be here to talk about his incredible career and the one thing he says guided him through the whole thing. Plus, when you go to a Doug Paisley show, you look around and the crowd is full of some of the best songwriters in Canada. They know how good Doug is, and now he has his new record produced by his good friend, Bahamas. He'll be here to tell you all about it, and we nerd out about one of our favorite Canadian songwriters. That's coming up. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. I mean, you gotta start here. I feel like the CBC just went off the air, or I feel like we're about to play the dating game or something like that. From 1966, that is a little bit of Spanish Flea by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. I'll tell you, when I told people I was interviewing Herb Alpert, that was the song they all hummed back at me. But Herb Alpert has done so much more. He's had an incredible career in music. Check this out. Back in the 60s, he establishes Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, which at the beginning, by the way, was Herb Alpert playing all the trumpet parts by himself. Those records sold millions and millions of copies. For a few years there, he was selling more records than the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And that's just his own music. But check this out. Herb wrote songs for Sam Cooke and Jan and Dean. He co-founded A&M Records, one of the most important record labels ever. The Carpenters, Joan Baez, Cat Stevens, Carole King. Herb Alpert is now 88 years old. He's still on the road. Last month, Herb was on tour in Western Canada. This month, starting this weekend, he's back to do some shows in Ontario and Quebec. 88. Ahead of those dates, I got to speak to the legendary Herb Alpert about his life in music over Zoom from his home in LA. Take a listen. How are you?
Hey, Tom. I'm good. I'm good. Very good. The world's a little crazy, but you know, I still feel okay.
I'm glad to hear it. I got to tell you, someone like you, with everything you've done, you'd be forgiven if you wanted to lie on a beach with a margarita. You know what I mean, for the rest of your life. What keeps you on the road?
Well, I think I would atrophy if I did that, actually. You know, doing these concerts, I've been doing concerts with my wife, Lonnie, for about 14 years now. And it gives me energy to do it. This is like something I look forward to, because when I'm playing the trumpet, when I'm sculpting, when I'm painting, I'm in the exact moment of my life. And that is a seductive place to be. Because, you know, a lot of times we're thinking about yesterday or tomorrow, but when I'm doing it, man, I'm right there. And I think that's the beauty part of doing these concerts. And I think the audience feels pretty much the same way. If they're into the music and they're engaged, that's the focus.
I love what you said there. I like that we have all these distractions in our lives now more than ever, with like phones and TV and news and everything. But when you're playing music, and occasionally when you're listening to music, but when you're playing music, if you're playing it the right way and you're playing it in the good way, you're just doing that. And there's nothing else that can possibly happen.
Absolutely. And I'm never doing it in the wrong way, because I'm always looking, you know, there's two types of musicians out there. There's the musicians that play the right notes exactly. They know exactly what to do. They know the chords. They're well schooled and they're disciplined. And there's the other musicians like me. I'm not a bebop musician. I'm not Miles Davis, but I'm looking for the right notes. I'm looking for the right feeling. And when you send that feeling, and some people get it, it's magic.
How did you end up playing the trumpet?
Okay, well, how much time you got? No, I was 8 years old. In my elementary school, there was a music class, and they had a table filled with various instruments, and I happened to pick up the trumpet. It just fit into my hand nicely, and it was good. I could have picked up a tuba. I could have picked up an oboe or a clarinet or trombone. I picked up the trumpet, started blowing hot air into it, and it doesn't work that way. I just thought it was just air that makes the thing work. So the beauty part of it is, once I started making noise with that trumpet, made a sound, it was talking for me, because I'm an introvert. I'm a card-carrying introvert, and this trumpet was saying all the things that I couldn't get out of my mouth. And so little by little, you know, it's been my best friend.
Were you good at it right away? Like, did you have the scales and the vowels and everything down right away?
No, I was terrible at it. I you know, it was just making funny sounds. You know, if I was practicing at home, people would shut their windows, man. You wouldn't want to hear me. It was tough.
Were you putting in hours? Like, eventually, did you start putting in like the 6, 7, 8 hour days?
No, I never did that. But I just put in enough time to make it fun. Little by little, you know, things started working for me. But the biggest lesson that I ever had, period, after, you know, I had the hit record, The Lonely Bull, and the Tijuana Brass was a big success. In 1969, I had a problem playing. And all of a sudden, I was stuttering through the trumpet. I couldn't get the first note out right. And so I heard about this teacher in New York City. His name was Carmine Caruso. And he was known as the troubleshooter.
Yeah.
And the first moment I met him, I said, Carmine, what am I doing wrong, man? I all of a sudden I can't play right. I said, should I change my mouthpiece or should I? Maybe it's the trumpet or something. He said, let me tell you something, kid. You're the instrument. The sound comes from within you.
Yeah.
And that trumpet you're holding is just a piece of plumbing. And when he said that, I looked at the horn. He was right, man. It's just a series of pipes. It's a piece of plumbing. He says, you're the instrument.
You start out by thinking that you have to manipulate this instrument in order to get the sound out you want of it, right? You start learning your scales. You start thinking that, like, okay, this thing is like a thing to be tackled. And eventually you realize that it's your personality. It's everything you've ever done. It's the way you talk. It's how you communicate. This instrument becomes like an apparatus for you to sort of express yourself.
You got it, brother. That's it. And I think that's good advice for kids. And I think it involves all the arts, because I see the arts as some mysterious thing that happens. You can't identify art. You can't go in there and say, you know, this is why he's doing it and this is why he plays those notes. No, you can't. Art is a feeling. You know, it's like you stand in front of a Jackson Pollock painting and try to analyze it. Forget it. You're lost. It ain't going to happen. Got to feel it. It's all about a feel. That's all it is. And we listen to some of the greatest artists, you know, the Billie Holidays of the world.
In my solitude, you haunt me.
You know, she didn't sing in tune all the time, and she was a little, you know, off center sometimes. But man, that feeling just goes right to your heart. Yeah. And that's what it's about. It's all about a feeling, I think.
Well, let's listen to some of this music that's the best music of all time. Sam, can you play the first track?
Don't know much about history.
Don't know much about biology.
Don't know much about science.
You want to talk about feel. You want to talk about, like, expression. That is Sam Cooke, Wonderful World. Herb Alpert's my guest. A track you wrote. How does this happen?
Oh, Lou Adler and I were partners. We wrote a song that was very, very similar to that song. Sam loved it. He took pieces of that song and, you know, it's put it into a Wonderful World. But here's the beautiful part about it. This is like nobody knows what a hit record sounds like. The company put that on the shelf. It was done as a demo because Sam wanted to see if the song would work. And then when Sam left Keen Records, he went to RCA Victor and he started having a lot of success with the records he was putting out. The company had this one record in the vault. They put it out you know what happened to the thing? It turned out to be the biggest selling record Sam ever had. You know, nobody knew it was a hit record, not even Sam.
You can't predict it.
Well, let me tell you something about Sam, because Sam was a teacher. Yeah. You know, he didn't know it, but he had something. He had that it, you know, the thing. Sam used to carry a notebook around with a bunch of lyrics. And he came up to me one day and he said, "Herbie, check out this lyric. Tell me what you think about it." So I was looking at this lyric, thinking to myself, "Man, this is the corniest thing I've ever seen." I didn't tell him what I was feeling, but I said, "What does the song sound like? What kind of melody do you have to this song?" Anyways, he picked up his guitar and started playing this, what I thought, corny lyric. And all of a sudden, man, it turned into magic. It was something about where he put the notes, the intent that he was playing with, his vibe, you know, his energy was so beautiful. And I was listening to it thinking, man, that's it. It ain't what you do. It's the way how you do it. And that's what I always started looking for when I was, you know, with A&M Records or writing a song or playing the instrument. I was looking for that feeling. It's about a feeling.
Let's listen to some more music. Take a listen to this. From 1962, that's Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass and Lonely Bull. It's your first big hit. When I played that for you just then, what went through your head? What were you thinking about?
Oh, I was thinking about the bullfight that I got inspired by. Not necessarily the bullfight, but there was it wasn't a mariachi band. I never listened to mariachi music, but there was a brass band in the stands, and they were introducing each event. They had a little different fanfare, like ba-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and the bull would run out, and then the matador would come out, and the horses would, I mean, it was that type of thing. And so I wanted to try to translate that feeling that I got in those afternoons in Tijuana into a song. I mean, the thing took me off guard. You know, I was playing parties and weddings before that, and all of a sudden I had this record that just took off like a rocket ship.
You went from, again, like playing parties and weddings to being famous after that, man. Like that Lonely Bull song took off. You became really identifiable. I mean, it's funny to think what you said earlier. You were like, I wanted to make sure that everything I do is of me, is a personal expression of me. And you said to me, the first thing you said to me was like, "Hey, I'm not a bebop guy. I'm not like Miles Davis." But didn't Miles Davis say about you, like, what did he say? If you hear three notes, I know it's Herb Alpert.
Yeah, well, that's what we're all looking for. We're looking for our own identifiable sound. You know, I spent time trying to play a little bit like Miles, trying to play like Louis Armstrong or Harry James or anything, you know, trumpet favorites that I like. Who cares? Who wants to hear that? They've already done it. So I was looking for my sound.
Did you meet any of those guys? Did you meet Miles?
Yeah. Yeah, I met Miles. I mean, I could tell you a story. I wouldn't want to say it on the air, some of the first things he said to me. But I met all those guys. Man, I played with Louis Armstrong. And here's the beauty of that. The thing that really just got right to me, I understood it, because the sound that came out of his trumpet. Was exactly the person I met, was exactly the person that had that personality and had that joyous feeling. He was about joy when he played. And it came right through the horn. And I said, man, that's an artist, man. That's what you have to be. You have to be honest to yourself. You can't affect it. You be who you are and be satisfied with that.
Let's listen to some more music. Take a listen to this.
Up.
That's A Taste of Honey from Herb Alpert's 1965 album, Whipped Cream and Other Delights. One of my favorite, incredible album cover. That record was so successful. It was a successful period for you generally. I just want to give some stats here so people understand just how big it got for you. October 1965 to April 1967, you and your group had at least one record in the U.S. top 10. In 1966, you sold over 13 million records. You had five albums in the Billboard top 20 at the same time that year, and you were outselling the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Now that we have a few decades out from that, what was that like, man? Like, what was it like to be in the middle of all that?
I don't know if I totally experienced it, and I never thought about it in the way you just described it. I can't honestly tell you whether I'm working at being humble or I'm just humble. But I don't think about those things. When you played that record, I thought about how the genesis of that thing and how it came about. My partner liked this song I did, the Third Man Theme. And we had Taste of Honey on the backside. It was the B-side. So this is when I got a group together in that period. There was no Tijuana Brass before that. So we were playing at a place in Seattle, Washington, called the Edgewater Inn. Every time I played that Taste of Honey with that pretty much arrangement that you just played, people went crazy for it. They loved it.
Yeah.
And so I called my partner. I said, Jerry, I thought you're on the wrong side. There's a focus group up here. And every time I played Taste of Honey, they really loved it. You got to flip the record. He says, no, man, you can't dance to it. It stops in the middle and starts twice and the boom, boom, boom. And I don't think it's for radio. I said, man, flip the record. I'm telling you, there's something going on. And so when he flipped that record, it took about two months before the thing hit. But when it hit, it was the catalyst for the Whipped Cream and Other Delights album and everything else that happened. And all the major shows, all of a sudden I was on all the major television shows because of that record. That was the record that did it.
I'm glad you had that focus group in front of you. I'm glad you were able, man. You know, real life feedback, you know?
There's nothing like it. The people know what they like and don't like, you know? And nobody knows what a hit record. Look at that. I was the A of A&M Records, and people used to come to me because they wanted us, A&M, to distribute their records. This guy comes in with his record and plays it for me, and I didn't like it, man. I thought it was too long. It was out of tune. And I don't usually comment on out of tune, but this was like bothering me, you know? And so I said, man, just because I ain't receiving this message, you know, don't take my word for it. We're going to have to pass on this record, but good luck. Well, that turned out to be Louie Louie.
Oh, no. Like the Kingsman, Louie Louie?
Yeah. I had egg all over my face on that one, but that's the way I've been operating. You know, I go with my gut. If it feels good, I'm in. If it doesn't, I'm out.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's be honest about that. If people only know that story about Louie Louie, they would think that, oh, yeah, well, I mean, you know, he passed on one of the biggest records of all time. You also took in a band that everybody else passed on and ended up becoming one of the biggest pop performers of all time. I mean, just take a listen to this.
Do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you. Why do stars fall?
So I should point out, my guest is Herb Alpert. In addition to being incredibly successful with his own music, he, as he mentioned, set up an incredibly successful record label, A&M Records, Sergio Mendes, Cat Stevens, later acts like the Police and Janet Jackson. But that's the one. The story I'd always heard about you is that everybody passed on the Carpenters and you heard it. You heard. What did you hear?
I heard something that felt real. Wasn't the type of music that I normally listen to. Something about her voice, for one. Something about how they put it together. And then when I met them, I realized they had something. They had something. Just a matter of like flagging themselves down to the runway. And luck be have it for them, because I had Close to You. I was going to do Close to You as a follow-up to This Guy's in Love with You. That's number one song I had as a vocalist.
You see this guy. This guy's in love with you.
I did a version of it, of Close to You. It was cool. It was like a samba thing. It had a feeling for it.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you.
And my head engineer at A&M, Larry Levine, rest his soul, I asked Larry, I said, man, tell me the truth. How do I sound singing this song? He said, you sound terrible singing this song. I said, what do you mean I sound terrible?
He said it to the boss too, man. Good for him.
Yeah. And so I lost my confidence. I don't think of myself as a singer, but I've lost it. You know, I put it in the drawer. And in 1970, I gave it to Richard Carpenter, and it turned to, you know, gold. It was, like, incredible.
On the day that you were born, the angels got together and decided to create a dream come true. So they sprinkled moon dust in your hair of gold, starlight in your eyes of blue.
It's hard for me to talk about Karen. She was beautiful.
Yeah, as much as you want to say, like, I loved when you talked about Sam Cooke earlier, because, I mean, I was born in the late 80s, so Sam Cooke to me is like, he's a historical figure more than a person. And Karen Carpenter's like that for me too, you know? Like, she's an icon to me, and I have to try and remind myself that she was real. What was she like?
She was innocent. She was like it's hard for me to, you know, I liked her so much.
Yeah.
She had no idea that she was a great singer. When I asked Karen, I said, Karen, what do you really love to do? What are you good at? She says, I'm a good drummer. That was her thing. And she had no idea that she had made so many hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people so happy about her. Her artistry. She was only 32 when she passed. And about a month before she passed on, she flew into my office, and she was so excited because she had come out of a rehab in New York and helped to fix the problem she had. She was excited about recording again and touring and doing all the things. And, you know, very shortly after that, she passed. And it's so sad because, I mean, they're still selling records to this day. It's an amazing, I can't talk about it.
Yeah, I understand. I talked to Richard not that long ago.
Well, Richard was greatly responsible. I mean, when you think about all the adulation you have for Karen, you got to remember that Richard knew how to get the best out of her.
Yeah.
I've met all these artists, man. They're all, including myself, they're all insecure.
Yeah.
You know, one way or another.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she needed somebody to steer the boat. And Richard knew how to do it. And she had something.
We've only just begun to live. White lace and promises, a kiss for luck and we're on our way.
We've only begun.
The car Carpenters, and we've only just begun. The Carpenters signed and championed, and as you heard, they're remembered by Herb Alpert. Coming up, Herb talks about more of the music he's made over the years. He remembers Burt Bacharach, who, of course, you know, wrote incredible songs for the likes of the Carpenters and just one of the greatest songwriters of all time. Plus, what advice can someone who had all this success in the 60s have for someone in the modern music business? Herb will tell you what matters no matter when you were born. Plus, one of the best songwriters in this country right now, Doug Paisley, coming up after this.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You see this guy? This guy's in love with you.
The weirdest thing just happened. The studio I'm in right now, the carpet turned into shag carpet, just like that. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Right now you're hearing This Guy's in Love with You by Herb Alpert. You're in the middle of my conversation with Herb Alpert. And this song was written by his friend, Burt Bacharach, who gave it to Herb. It made Herb's first number one. Burt Bacharach, by the way, legendary songwriter, wrote The Look of Love, I Say a Little Prayer. He wrote Close to You for the Carpenters. And Burt Bacharach died in February of this year, and I got to ask Herb a little bit about him. Plus, the music industry in the 1960s is so different from 2023, right? Like, it was vinyl records and tape back then. It's TikTok and Spotify now. Is there any advice that Herb, this incredibly successful musician, could give to younger artists? The answer is... not really. No, I'm kidding. The answer is yes. Herb has some great advice coming up. Herb Alpert is 88 years old. He's an incredible storyteller. Here's the rest of our conversation. I wanted to ask you about Bacharach, too. I mean, like, who I also know we just lost a little while ago. Not that. When did we live? In February? Just the other month, right?
Yeah, I played it as a memorial. I played Alfie on the trumpet.
What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live?
Yeah, you know, he was a dear friend of mine, especially during the pandemic. For the last 3 years, we would talk like once a week, and he was a full-bodied guy. He wasn't into himself. He wasn't into all those songs. We talk about sports. We talk about football. He loved football. You know, he loved professional football and politics and little nuances in politics and who he's supporting, who he's not. And he was working on a musical project. He was doing some music with, I can't think of the guy's name, in Nashville.
Yeah.
And he was working on this one song. I said, how's it going? He says, man, it's a good song, but I can't think of a bleep F-bomb ending for this song. I mean, with the you know, thousands of songs that this guy has written, he was a genius, man. He wasn't into that. He was into the problem, trying to find an ending for the song. And he was a good friend. You know, he wasn't like, he was like, you know, how's Lonnie? What you doing? How's it going for you? You know, he was a real good guy, good person, good friend.
Yeah. I was just listening to, just yesterday I was listening to I'll Never Fall in Love Again.
What do you get when you fall in love? A guy with a pin to thirst your love. Oh, that's what you get for all your trouble. I never fall in love again. I'll never fall in love again.
Which is like one of my favorite songs of all time. I can listen to that song every single day, four or five times. I love it. I love the bridge. I love everything about it. Is that you on trumpet on that? That bum bum da ba da da bum bum.
No, Oh, no, but he swiped my my phrasing. In fact, you know, Bert called me from London. I don't remember the year exactly, and he wasn't happy with the song he was doing for Casino Royale. He had the track, but he didn't like whoever was playing on top of it or singing on top of it. He called me. I was in Los Angeles. He says, "Look, I'm in trouble. I got a song here that I'd love for you to try to put the horn on." I said, "Well, play it for me over the phone. Let me just hear what it's like, because I can't play anything unless I feel it. You know, unless the melody is there." So he sang. He was singing this song for me, and I said, "Yeah, I could do that." So he sent me the tape. The 16-track tape, recorded it with my engineer friend who said I...
that you stunk?
I stunk. Anyways, he actually recorded most of the Tijuana Brass records. Yeah. Anyways, we recorded it. It took me a couple hours to put the horn on. And I kind of aped it pretty much the way Bert sang it to me. He did little nuances as well. But you do little nuanced things. Anyways, 2 weeks later, man, it was the title song of that movie. So it was just one of those things.
I love what you said there. I love that he did. He asked you to do that. And I love that you said he swiped your phrasing a little bit, because he did. Because when I knew I was talking to you, and I heard the, and I was like, I bet that's Herb Albert. I bet that's Herb Albert.
Yeah, no, he knew he swiped it, but he copped to it.
let me play one more song for you here. I want to play the song that everybody. I got to tell you, for better or for worse, and I love this song. Every time I said I'm talking to Herb Alpert, they would sing it for me. Let's play it. It's really good. That's Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass and Spanish Flea. Can you tell me something about that?
Yeah, there's something about it. It's different. It feels good. But there were a couple of people in my company didn't like the song, didn't think that we should release that as a single. But I always go on what I feel, you know. I don't have any magic ideas in terms of what a hit record sounds like or not. I just know I try to make interesting records, good records. You know, I think I have my own, I know I have my own sound, and I try to put that sound to good use. If I'm playing a song that's familiar with others, I try to do it in a way that hasn't been heard quite that way before. And that's what I'm stuck doing, man. I try.
I'm stuck. I mean, you're stuck doing it.
Well, I can't stop. You know, it's like I'm passionate about it. And I tell kids, you know, when they ask me, what's the secret of your success? I said, there's no secret, man. Be passionate about what you're doing. Because if you're not, while you're sleeping, these other kids are practicing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because if there's one thing that occurs to me while I was doing research for this, is just that it was a different time, man. Like, even just when you were telling me that story, the Bacharach called you on the phone and played you something over the phone, and he mailed you over something, and you brought in your engineer. That can all be done now in like 10 seconds. Also, like, physical copies are different versus streaming. TikTok is bigger than ever. I mean, you had a big TikTok hit sort of out of nowhere recently. I mean, that was wild to watch one of your songs blow up on TikTok.
Hey, man, it's totally nuts for me. I had a Wepcor wire recorder. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like pre-tape.
Pre-tape. I mean, if you wanted to edit, you'd use the soldering iron, you know?
But is there advice that you have for any musicians who are listening to this right now that kind of transcends the era, transcends the medium, transcends all this stuff we're talking about?
It's complicated out there now. I mean, you got to know how to work the medium. You have to social contacts and all that stuff that's way out of my area. But Look, unless they're passionate, unless you're passionate about you, what you're doing as a musician, don't even try. You know, I have a jazz club here in Los Angeles, and I hear musicians you never heard of, man. They're just fantastically great. And so it's rough out there. Unless you're really committed, unless you're really, this is what you have to do the rest of your life, don't even try it. There's too many great musicians out there, and you got to do it for the right reasons. Don't do it because you want to make money or you want to attract women or men or whatever it is. You know, it's like, you got to have heart.
All you really need is heart.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep that stuff about feel and art being about feel and being about a personal expression. Herb Alpert, I've been looking forward to talking to you all week. Thanks so much for making the time for us.
Hey, man, it's a pleasure. Yeah, I had a good time. Thanks.
Herb Alpert, legendary trumpet player, music icon, sort of like font of knowledge, font of wisdom, is on tour in Ontario and Quebec. He's playing Toronto this weekend, and then Hamilton, Kingston, Ottawa, and Montreal.
And pale blue eyes, softly crying, my love is gone, so to carry on.
That is Doug Paisley and the title track from his brand new record, Say What You Like. You know, if I can be accused of droning on about anything, and believe me, I can, it's probably that I'm from Newfoundland and Labrador. It's probably something about the banjo. And for my friends, it's that Doug Paisley is one of the best songwriters in Canada right now. I keep going on and on about it. His new album, as I mentioned, Say What You Like, was made with one of his good friends, a former roommate, another one of Canada's great songwriters, Afi Yurvinen, a.k.a. Bahamas. Produced this new record and kind of made it happen. Say What You Like is out now, and Doug Paisley came into the studio to talk about how the record came together, his approach to songwriting. But we started out by talking about how the last time Doug was here, he had his acoustic guitar in his hand. He was performing live on the show, and how things feel a little bit different this time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm great. You know, I miss playing live, but it's also very relaxing not to be thinking about playing, you know, just talking. So I feel great.
I feel like every time we had someone on, and I miss it. I miss having like musicians and all that stuff in, but I feel like every time I would be talking to them, I could see in the back of their mind, they'd be like, okay, what do I got? Is the guitar in tune?
Exactly.
Is this going to go all right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Is it okay?
Yeah. Which sometimes is good if your mind is totally somewhere else, but we'll see. Maybe it's not a good thing that my mind is right here with you today.
Maybe this is going to be the most terrifying interview of
right,
my life.
Yeah.
My understanding is you had like something like 250 songs.
A lot of songs. Yeah. A lot of, you know, in various states of completion down to very small fragments. But yeah, in terms of what I gave Afi, you know, I gave him several sort of playlists of songs to kind of go through and just say yes, no, basically.
So how does Afi get involved? I know you guys are buddies. I think I have occasionally gone to see you Wednesdays at the Cameron House in downtown Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
You occasionally do this great monthly residency. Mm-hmm. It's Golden Country Classics.
Exactly.
And I think I was there one time when Afi got up with you guys and played a bunch of old country songs.
Yeah.
So you guys are buddies?
Oh, yeah. We were roommates. We've been buddies for a long time. He's so much more than that to me in music. He really pushes me. He's a real inspiration. He's kind of a mentor. He's got a much clearer head than me in a lot of areas, you know, and he's got a lot of patience with what I am and what I'm not. But we fundamentally, aside from being friends, we share a lot of musical sensibilities.
So how does this happen where does Afi come to you and say, hey, let's make a record together?
I mean, I guess he probably had his own, not that I was going to be the cash cow or anything, but I think he had his own interest in getting into this and maybe exploring it. So maybe that's why it was there. Personally, I assume that, you know, he's just got, as we know from what he achieves and how much he's done, he's got a really great drive, and he's probably a lot less of a self-doubter, at least in public ways, you know, than I am. And so I think I feel like he sensed that I was a bit hung up, maybe. Not in some terrible, tragic way. But I think he sort of said, look, it's not that hard. You know, you take the songs into the studio, you record them, it comes out on an album. Like, you know, I think he felt maybe that I was a bit in the irons or whatever. And so he pushed it along in that way.
So did you go out to Nova Scotia with AFI and make the record out there? Is that how you did it? Or
no, he very kindly came here, and Bahamas, the band, a lot of the players, they're all based, we're all within a few blocks of each other, you know, so it was very easy to just come and land here.
Because I think every time I'll just ask it, what was the experience like of like working with someone else's band and someone bringing in all these other kind of musicians to your songs?
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, I was giddy. Partly because when you're hearing great playing, it's so exciting, if, you know, when you love music, but they have so much, you know, communication and synergy and understanding with each other. And I think they seem to have a very healthy, positive hierarchy within. So I think that his direction, you know, resonates in a nice way. Like, it was just a beautiful environment. Like, I basically had to walk in with my guitar and everything was just unfolding around me. So it was amazing. And I was listening to it when we were talking about choosing a song for this. I was listening to it and I was like, I feel so relaxed. I think I just was so relaxed. So it was excellent.
Are you changed by it? Are you a different person, a different artist now after making this record? Big question, I know, but
I mean, of course, like, you know, I guess you they're always moving you forward. And then there were just technical experiences I had there, which I hadn't had before. Things like click tracks, technical things that, you know, most people don't even really think about or know about. I think it was such a beautiful gift for him to do that for me. I really saw it that way.
Yeah.
And just for someone to do that for somebody else, it's really emotional. You know, it's funny. I drove him to the airport on the last day because we did this like in less than a week.
Wow.
And it was like one of those things that was like kind of almost embarrassing to say, but I was like, you're like an angel for me because you've done this and you've made this. And it was just lovely, you know?
Tell me about Wide Open Plain. What do you remember about writing it?
Well, I actually remember where I wrote it, where I started it. I was in a venue called The Smell in Los Angeles.
The Smell?
Yeah. And I was in a duo called Dark Hand and Lamplight with Canadian artist Sherry Boyle. Uh-huh. And we were opening for Bonnie Prince Billy. And it was the craziest tour because we would play the Malibu Performing Arts Center one night. And then the next night was like this dive in L.A. And I mean, I don't know if that has any bearing on the song, but I do remember being behind the stage in this like really kind of not very nice. It, they didn't in any way purport to be a nice venue.
I get the vibe from the name, The Smell, Doug.
You get it.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I just had the line and and it was, I just was so connected to the instrumental line. And I don't know that I had maybe a little bit of the lyrics. And then when I was back in Toronto, actually, I think when AFI was living in my house, and it was the determination that it was a song that was worth, you know, finishing. But it really started with just a musical idea, which is strange because it has so many words.
What is it about? Can you articulate that?
I think it's... it's sort of obviously kind of apocalyptic, but then I feel like it sort of has some bravery in it around facing that. I don't think it's specifically so much about something as that, there's so many like ballads and these long songs, and I really wanted to try and participate in that kind of songwriting.
Yeah, yeah.
And really go with an idea. And but yeah, it was a sort of one of those other voice type songs where I know I worked on it a lot, but I also remember that when it came to all those verses, I wrote it very quickly. So I hope I didn't just completely skirt your question.
No. I mean, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. It reminds me of when, I mean, I know you and I are both big Bob Dylan fans.
Yeah.
That's the way he talks about some of his early songs. That's the way he talks about It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding, right? Which is, in my opinion, his best song.
Yeah.
Or maybe his second best song. And he'll say, don't ask me, I didn't write it.
Well, he goes on 60 Minutes and he quotes the song. And he's like, can you believe that?
The darkness at the break of noon. He says it like that.
Yeah.
Shallow Eden, the silver spoon, the handmade blade, the child's balloon.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't write that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
Doug, thanks for coming in. Let's play the song.
All right, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
This is Doug Paisley from his new album, Say What You Like. This is Wide Open Plain on Q.
From his brand new album, Say What You Like, that's Doug Paisley with the song Wide Open Plain. If you're in the Toronto area, Doug Paisley is playing the TD Music Hall in Toronto on Saturday night. I'll be there. And that is it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, Talia Schlanger will be sitting in for me. I'm taking a couple of days off. Nita Manzoor will be here as well. Nita Manzoor does not get bothered by expectations. She challenges them through her breakout sitcom, We Are Lady Parts, or her debut feature film, Polite Society. She'll be here to talk about why battling perceptions of Muslim women in an entertaining way is so important. See you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.